from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you. And from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll get a preview of a new musical at Ball State based on Kathy Day's novel, A Circus in Winter.
I'll find out why the Actors Theater of Indiana thinks it's a grand night for singing.
And I get to talk with the new winner of the Indiana Authors Award.
Who is it? I can't tell yet.
You've got to listen to the rest of the show. What I can tell you is that we'll also have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Stay tuned. Indiana author Kathy Day's first novel, The Circus in Winter, is now being turned into a musical by students at Ball State University. Travis DiNicola spoke with Beth Turcotte, Associate Professor of Theater at Ball State, along with students Jonathan Jensen and Ben Clark.
Beth, Jonathan, Ben, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you in our studio today.
Thanks so much.
Beth, I want to start with you about how this all began. And let me just preface this by saying, I mean, anyone who's listened to Art of the Matter knows I'm a huge fan of Kathy Day. Love her work. She's been on here talking about Circus in Winter as well as Comeback Season. And when I first heard, though, that... You know where I'm going with this.
Yes, I do.
I love the book Circus in Winter. Okay. But when I first heard that it was being turned into a musical, I thought, my first thought was, that's so cool, great for Kathy. Then I thought, who the hell would turn that into a musical? As much as I love the book, I mean, it's filled with a lot of loss and regret, and it's beautifully written, but it is a sad book. But
it is a sad book. But musicals don't always have to be happy. There's certainly redeeming moments and a journey that our lead character follows. So it's, you know, he learns and grows and changes.
You were actually kind of looking for a story, though, about what? Perseverance, survival.
Yes.
I mean, to turn into a musical?
Yes, it was going to be through this particular grant, a group of students were going to write a musical about people who had overcome difficulties to go on to do magical things for the United States. And I took it more kind of the Obama feel that was going on, you know, Americans can do it kind of thing.
So now that was the dictate of the grant specifically?
That was something you really wanted to look at.
Yeah,
it's, you know, something hopeful. And we met early as a group, and someone in the class mentioned, have you ever read The Circus in Winter? And I said, no. And they said, well, what is it about? And they said, you know, circus, it's Peru, Indiana, Kathy Day was, who's your author? And I thought, son of a gun. I said, that sounds terrific. So I said, I found out that a gentleman, a professor at Ball State, used her book in his humanities courses.
Mm-hmm.
So I called him up, and Tony Edmonds, and I said, so how can I get a hold of her? And he told me, I did. She said, yeah, and it was like, things just moved from there.
And this started, what, about a year ago or so?
About a year and a half ago.
Wow,
yeah.
Okay. I got to ask. Okay.
Okay,
so what did Kathy say when you called her up?
She is so gracious and so just a lovely, lovely person. She was thrilled to death, you know, but she was like, how am I going to take this book, whip it down to, you know, something that can be done in 2 hours, you know, on stage.
Well, and the book is, for those who haven't read it, it's set in the fictional town of Lima, Peru, and Lima, Indiana, based on Peru, and deals with the circus that's there, that winters there, and it's a number of short interconnected stories that make up the novel, sort of over a period of about 100 years or so that it covers. So gentlemen, Jonathan, Ben, tell me about your involvement in this. Jonathan, I know you just graduated in musical theater. Ben, you're a senior right now in musical theater, is that right?
Yeah.
So you were in a class specifically to write a musical, or how does that go about?
Yeah, it was an immersive class where us writing the musical, we had the whole spring semester, and we'd get 15 hours credit for doing so. So, I mean, basically all the 15 kids involved in the group took maybe one to two outside classes, but the majority of our time, like the vast majority, was spent working on the show. And, you know, between script work and research and, you know, composition in my case, like everybody kind of took a different part.
And you worked specifically on the music composition, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, and Jonathan?
I helped write a lot of the book and the scenes and things like that that go along with
a lot of lyrics,
but you can't just pin it down on the two of us either. It was really a true collaboration with the other 15 students and Beth, because there would be days where somebody would write a scene and it would get to the point that it could with that person writing it, and somebody would take it from them and mold it in their own way, and then we kind of threw them all together at one point in time and saw how it all fit. And
This class was made up of musicians, actors, writers,
English majors, telecom.
TCOM majors. It was just it's a university course where different people come in from all areas that are interested in a specific project. And with the musical, you know, you just said, we're going to write a musical, and this herd of people showed up, and it was fantastic.
Now, had you done this course before at all?
No, it's offered to the Virginia Ball Center at Ball State, and I waited to apply when I knew I had the right core of people to start this piece, and I ended up having the right beautiful, wonderful group of students.
Because I was picturing, like, if you'd done this before, maybe like a musical based on Nietzsche's work or something.
I've taught musical theater and started the musical theater program at Ball State 28 years ago. So I've been, you know, involved quite a bit. But we ended up just using pretty much the first chapter of the book, Following Wallace Porter's Life.
Okay.
So that's how we kind of honed it in. And we had Sutton Foster came in and worked with us, as did Kathy Day, Susan Zeter, Ken Dingledine, who's the publisher from Samuel French in New York. So we, you know, we had wonderful guest artists to help kind of ignite or move us into other directions. So it was a really wonderful group.
Now, you've had one staging of it already and have another one coming up? You've had two. Okay, catch me up on that.
We did one at Ball State for our first one in Sursa Hall, and then we were very fortunate to perform up at Drury Lane Theater in Chicago, and which was a wonderful experience. They were doing the show...
Ragtime,
and so we were on their that set.
Okay.
And,
oh, great!
Yeah,
had to go
perfect.
Well with it. I'm sure.
Yes, it was fabulous.
So then, as part of the circus days up in Peru this summer, July 17th and 18th, you're doing a concert version of it.
Right. Uh-huh. Correct.
Okay, so tell me about that.
Well, basically, a concert version is we take our script and our music and we perform it with music stands and act it as a basic show that so people can hear it and see it and. Understand it for the first time,
but not fully staged though. Who's going to be performing this?
I'll be performing Wallace Porter.
Okay.
And Ben will be doing most of the music.
Yeah, musical direction, pit stuff.
And then we have 18 other performers in it, and we worked on it this summer. So through rewrites, we did some rewriting, and now we're going to perform it again to get another idea of other rewrites, and then we will perform it. Fully.
A full production
in the fall of 2011.
Okay, so about a year from now.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
They'll give us time for rewrites and changes. And
wow. Yeah. Ben, how do you approach writing music for something like this? I mean, you know, there's certainly a lot of traditional circus music that comes to mind.
I've been writing music since I was about 14, but... being involved with so many musicals, I've gotten a chance to perform and, you know, a Sondheim and you know, a bunch of really, really good shows. And so I kind of had just analyzed everything that I had been a part of as far as, like, you know, structure and how musicals work and even some Gershwin operas and stuff like that. And that was kind of like the prep I did for going into it. But, I mean, really what I looked for, I mean, besides, you know, there's, you know, because you've got the circus thing to deal with, but then also... You know, what is Indiana music and what is Midwestern music and what gets people, what attaches people to what is going to attach these people to the show.
I'm hearing Cole Porter here. Yeah, especially
not so much. I kind of went towards a folk feel.
Okay.
And did, you know, because I mean, the thing I write, you know, more rock pop kind of music. So I mean that, you know. Putting the perfect thing, you know, would be kind of Mellencamp, But I kind of explored some new folk artists, you know, where the indie folk genre is going right now with bands like Fleet Foxes and local natives and some other smaller Ryan Adams, things like that. Okay. And then busting into my dad's record collection, found some things like Neil Young and Joni Mitchell and
The oldies.
Stevens. Yeah. But some of the best music that's been written in the past 50 years and probably for the next decade. And I did the majority of my work, I think, went into listening and then taking all the lyrical and melodic and stylistic ideas and putting them into a musical theater format. So it seems like it's working, and I'm kind of flying by the seat of my pants personally, but it's fun. So,
Jonathan, let me ask you sort of the same question. How did you approach this in terms of your writing? Using, I'm guessing, a lot of Kathy's words when you can.
Of course. First off, we started with obviously reading the novel, and once we gathered all the information and where we wanted to start with the piece, we all kind of came to a consensus as to what each character's journey was going to be in the story. And when we found the journey, we were able to determine how we would write scenes, and especially which scenes from the novel we would be able to include, and then where we would have to kind of fill in gaps in certain places. And I think that helped both Ben and I and the rest of the group, because we could all kind of work off of each other. When there was a specific spot that needed to be written, we knew that that could be, but then there were other places to experiment with scenes, and that would maybe bring up a new idea for the character to travel through. And
plus, we had two young designers and that are twins, the Swaters. So conceptually, they brought some things to the table that kind of pulled us into some of the directions. And so it was really a really wonderful group effort with different points of view.
Now, at some point, Kathy Day actually sat in with you guys while you were working on this, right? I mean, how was that for you as a writer, working with the writer that you're adapting her book into a musical?
It was interesting.
Terrifying at
first. Yeah, it was, because we wanted to be able to respect her book, knowing that we had changed a lot. And not changing a lot as far as, making the characters completely different people, but it not being the same through line, because her story is so episodic.
Yes.
And making it a linear plot line almost, it was a big challenge. And the moment that she said, this encapsulates every character and the heart of my book, was probably the best reward we could have asked for, because it was wonderful that we were able to kind of translate everything into a different language and it still mean the same thing.
And she came to the first show and sat in the front row and was just like a kid at the circus, it was thrilling for us to have her there.
Now, and all of this is happening before any of you knew that Kathy was going to be coming back to Indiana.
Right.
Yeah. And she's going to be coming back to...
As a professor in the English department.
At Ball
Creative
State.
Writing. Absolutely.
Right, which...
The whole thing
and that
is
all
a
happened
circle.
After the fact. I mean, that's just kind of crazy.
Yeah, because her family's still in Peru, and, so it's really just been a magical journey, and she interviewed for the job on that Friday that we performed at Ball State, so it was just that magical.
Yeah, because she's been teaching out at University of Pittsburgh past couple years and such. So next fall, when you do a full staging of this, now are you guys going to be around?
I'm going to be here.
Okay,
I'm going to be the musical director for that show
as a guest artist.
Excellent. And Jonathan, will you be able to?
I won't be able to participate, unfortunately. As much as I would love to, I'd love to hang on to my part as long as possible. But we'll let it be cast with all the students at Ball State, and it'll be wonderful.
Great. Well, what a great experience for you guys as students to be a part of this. And Beth, congratulations on this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is kind of like, my capstone. It seems like everything that I've done and people that I've met have led to this experience and this opportunity.
And, of course, Ball State is just the start, right? Because then afterwards you're...
Yeah, we're going to enter it in musical theater.
Festivals in New
festivals
York.
And hopefully one in New Harmony, Indiana, they have every year.
Excellent. So, well, I'm looking forward to following this story as it continues to unfold. Ben, Jonathan, you guys are going to perform one of the songs from the show. Tell me what it is and give me a little context for the song.
This song is called Running to Get What's Mine. It's the second song that comes up in the musical, and it's basically the moment that Wallace Porter, the livery stable owner, who is also the main character throughout the story, speaking to his cousin, Emery Hunt, about how he's not really satisfied with what he has going on in Lima, Indiana. And they're getting ready to go on a trip to New York City, and this is kind of the song that establishes what Porter wants out of his life and what's going to take precedence for the rest of the musical.
Okay, let's give it a listen.
My heart don't pound as hard as a hammer for anybody anywhere. My hands are hard as rock. Let them rest in peace. If you're being called, by all means, take your life and take flight. I can hear the calling, getting on the train come twilight, crossing over the county line, headed into a different sky, walking in a city where it looks like a different world. What I find is what I'm bringing back to the county line, running to get what's mine. Life don't wait around, brother. You gotta go out there and capture it. I can hear the whistle come in. Listen to it blow. I've had this place all figured out for years, and I need to break out. I've come of age, adventure, something I shouldn't live without. Crossing over the county line, headed into a different sky. Walking in the city where it looks like a different world. What I find is what I'm bringing back to the county line, running to get what's mine. And it's not 'cause money's burning a hole in my jeans. No one knows really what getting away from this means. What it's like crossing over the county line, headed into a different sky, running to get what's mine, running to get what's mine.
Travis DiNicola with Beth Turcott, Associate Professor of Theater at Ball State, along with students Jonathan Jensen and Ben Clark. Jensen, a graduate of the musical theater program, currently is performing the lead in Circus in Winter and wrote much of the script for the show. Clark, a senior in musical theater, wrote the music and is the musical director. They're performing a concert version of the show in Peru, appropriately, on July 17th and 18th, and it will be fully staged at BSU during fall of 2011. For more information, visit bsu.edu/thecircusinwinter. So bsu.edu/thecircusinwinter. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
A grand night for singing is not only a lively tune from the great tradition of musical theater, it's the name of a musical revue that Actors Theater of Indiana has just opened at the Carmel Community Playhouse. Don Farrell dropped in to tell Sharon Gamble why it is a grand night for singing.
If I look at when you first started this company, and that's a U plural, and I look at a grand night for singing, I can't think of a better pairing of talent and vehicle. How did you decide, and when did you decide a grand night for singing would be a good addition to your season?
A grand night for singing has been... It's a beautiful piece. One of the very first musical reviews ever done, ever compiled, of Rodgers and Hammerstein's vast amount of work. And we always thought, you know, this would be a wonderful addition to our season sometime during the summertime, because we do present during the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's full of hope and love and all those wonderful romantic ideas and that Rodgers and Hammerstein are so famous for. But also, you know, one of the things that we were so excited about, and we decided this, to answer your question, we decided this probably end of last year,
mm-hmm.
that we thought, okay, this is going to be a good time slot for this show. But we, of course, we've been, you know, we're nomads, so to speak, and we've been presenting around town
sure.
for the past 5 years, and now we're up in Carmel for the time being, and enjoying that at Clay Terrace. It's beautiful, restaurants, plenty of parking, all that good stuff. And we thought this would be a great fit for, A, the time period, B, the setting, and C, the casting pool, the wonderful casting pool we have here in Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And so, so yeah, we were able to solidify that and get the rights to do Grand Night for Singing.
I have a question. It's hard to imagine there's somebody who's never seen a musical review, but there might be somebody listening who doesn't know what a review is. So what is a review?
Well, for Grand Night for Singing, it takes all of the different songs that people are that associate with Rodgers and Hammerstein and all of their different musicals, whether it's Oklahoma or South Pacific or... you can just go on and on and on. There's so many
yeah.
of them. But one of the great things that Walter Bobby was able to do, and this is a true testament to the genius of their work, is to be able to take those songs and take them out of context. So we're allowing the songs to speak for themselves, and they really are timeless because you can take them out of Oklahoma and listen to those lyrics and put it in a different setting, and it still has just as much relevance, if not more, today. And so that's one of the that's a true testament to that their songs are completely timeless.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, it's a celebration of their work, and we have I'm directing and choreographing the show, and I'm putting my own little spin on it and being able to tell my own little story with it, which I'm very excited about. And you know, of course, the 80% of a good director is really in good casting. And I have the wonderful talents of my...
I don't know that that secret is meant to get out there.
Okay, just between you and me.
Okay, sure.
Okay, we won't tell anybody. But the casting talent that we've been able to assemble for this, of course, my two co-founders, Judy Fitzgerald and Cynthia Collins. But also, we have some amazingly talented people. Bradley Reynolds, who's been on our stage several times before and a local, went to Speedway High School. And he just recently, a 2010 Broadway Tony nominee for producing Ragtime's revival. And, of course, he has all these other properties that he's going to be bringing to New York. So he's going to be on the stage with us.
Cool.
And we also have the former Miss Indiana, Jill O'Malley, who's going to be in there. She is just not only is she beautiful and stunning and talented and a gorgeous voice, but she just adds such a nice compliment to the cast. And then we have Jay Emmerich, who's also worked with Actors Theater of Indiana before in some past shows. But we're saving him for some specialty numbers. And then it's going to be music directed by Nathan Perry. So,
how do you will you do live instrumental accompaniment? Will you do a track?
No, we I don't want to say never, because you always get in trouble whenever you say never.
Sure.
But we always try our best to always have live instruments. And so this is going to be a band of, I think, four. It's typically scored for harp, and that's a difficult instrument to come by. Not only to find a good harpist, but also to transport that expensive instrument into that stage. And
of course, there's the time factor, because as everyone knows, harpists spend half of their time tuning and half the other half of the time retuning. No offense to harpists, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, exactly. So
summer, humidity, I'm just saying.
Oh, it does. It does. And that's what makes that instrument so beautiful.
Yeah.
when all of those factors are handled correctly, like the ISO, good thing they have that. They have sensitive, you know, the climate control in that space and stuff like that. So
harp, keyboard?
Keyboard, piano, percussion, reed. And the reed's going to be, I believe that's flute.
Maybe a sax?
Yes, sax. Mm-hmm. There's alto and tenor sax and flute and clarinet.
Sidetracking a little bit, no pun intended, but mm-hmm. Why is it desirable to perform with live three-dimensional musicians as opposed to a pre-recorded track?
Well, one of the great things about live theater is that you're experiencing something unique that's happening in the moment. You can go and see a movie on a Monday night, and you can go see that same movie again on Friday night, and you'll get the same performance. Whereas with theater, give and take of, and not only between the audience and the performer, but also from the performer and the artist behind the instrument. And that give and take, that ebb and flow that happens, really helps create, you know, at one point, one evening, one performance, the artist, the singer might be feeling this musical phrase in this way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the next night, it might be happening in a different way. Because
and the track's not going to adjust.
The track is not going to adjust. You're going to be locked in, and that's going to limit the experience that the audience is going to be able to receive, in my philosophy of
it. And there might be a night when somebody holds that high C an extra few bars, and because she's feeling frisky, and the live instrumentalist can work with that.
Amen.
Yeah. Is there a story that's told through the, and there are more than, is it 30 songs? Can that be right?
There are, yes. It's a lot. There's a lot of songs. And really, what I'm going to do with this show is I'm taking any type of dialogue, for the most part, out of the script.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really letting the lyrics and the music tell the story in how the songs have been juxtaposed against each other. And the storyline is, as we all know, day in and day out, how busy and how hard we all work during our work week. Well, the concept is it's the weekend, and four people of different varying occupations are coming to experience this one weekend getaway. Think a little night music, but instead of that, it's Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of Sondheim, Rodgers and Hammerstein. And those four are coming to, they have one friend in common, and that's going to be the Jill O'Malley role.
Uh-huh.
And those four people don't know each other, and they're all coming to experience a good respite from their work week. And through that weekend, they get to know each other, and maybe romances evolve, and maybe they have some spats and things like that, and it all works itself out in the end with a grand night for singing.
Uh-huh.
So grand night for singing really meaning, you know, that's our little escape away from the day in and day out troubles of the world.
But meantime, there's some flirtations, there's some I'm through with men, I'm going to wash that man right out of my hair.
Absolutely.
Kind of feeling. There's how are you working Kansas City in there?
Well, you just got to come and see.
No, you're not going to tell us. how do you solve a problem like Maria? What are some Shall We Dance? Is
Shall
one of
We
songs?
Dance? Honey Bun, traditionally done, as everyone knows, in South Pacific in the standard way. But we're not going to be.
Wait,
wait.
Somebody
are not
might
doing,
not know.
Well,
there are
Honey
coconut
Bun,
shells
there
involved.
There are coconut shells involved and grass skirts. However, we won't be going there, but we might be putting on tap shoes instead.
Oh.
So a new take on a good old standard.
Mm-hmm.
And the arrangements, the musical arrangements, really, if anything, just to come and listen to how these songs have been reorchestrated. The genius of Michael Gibson and Jonathan Tunick, those orchestrations and the musical arrangements, the vocal musical arrangements done by Fred Wells, just not only from an audience standpoint, but boy howdy, from a performer standpoint, this is some great music to sing. So it's very exciting.
Sing and dance too.
Sing and
because
dance.
Because there's choreography.
Yes.
Are all the characters on stage all the time?
No, not the entire show. Not the entire show. Some characters will leave. Some of the actors will leave at the time, and there'll be a more introspective moment.
Yeah, so a chance for some solos, a chance for some duets.
Duets,
yeah.
Absolutely.
It seems to be part of the pleasure of seeing a review, and particularly this one, is the background or experiences we all might bring from, gee, I remember the first time that I heard that musical or the first time that I saw that musical.
Mm-hmm.
But here it is in a brand new context.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's very exciting. I can't believe it's taken till, well, of course, now it's over 10 years since when they first came out with it in 93. And then I think it was on the Broadway season in 1994. But I can't believe that even then, the first time for a review of their music, because they've been around forever.
Right.
You know, actually, July is going to be the... we're celebrating Oscar Hammerstein's birthday. His birthday is in July. Of course, Richard Rodgers, I think he would be 108 years old now. it's been a long time. And
right.
Waiting all the way to 93, 94 for the first review of it. And it's exciting. And so that's one of the things we've been wanting to another reason we wanted to get that into our season sometime soon.
And they wrote so much. In fact, it sounds kind of like a joke, but there's some a nugget of truth in it. If you're trying to answer a trivia question about some musical and you don't know who wrote it, Rodgers and Hammerstein is kind of the default answer.
Always default.
You're probably going to be right.
You are. Yeah, and you know what? They really were. Their works, whether individually or collaboratively, have done more for the American musical stage than really any artist, as far as structure. They had groundbreaking ideas. They think about during those times where they were introducing a socioeconomic status structure between Curly in Oklahoma, who's a landowner, and Judd, the antagonist, who's a hired help. So they were commenting on socioeconomic status structures at that time. And even
but did it so subtly. That,
did it very subtly. Yeah. Racism and bigotry with South Pacific, right. Lieutenant Cable's You've Got to Be Taught. I mean, those are some really heavy issues to be able to be addressed and at that time, and even so today. So, again, another testament to their genius.
And to still be able to pull that off with charm and aplomb and mm-hmm. graciousness. Do you have a favorite song from Grand Night for Singing?
Oh, my goodness.
And I should mention, as we're having this conversation, you're still rehearsing.
We are.
Your answer is subject to change.
It changes every day, yeah, depending on what we're rehearsing at the
right.
time. This Nearly Was Mine, beautiful song, beautiful song. Of course, Honey Bun, we're having a lot of fun with that one, I tell you. Dusting those tap shoes off, and it's a lot of fun. I don't know. You know, it's so hard to be able to place, put your finger on one specific song. I'll tell you one thing. I'm a father, and my daughter's 5 years old, Lizzie. Elizabeth is her name. And when Judy, my wife, called, who's also my colleague, when she called to tell me she was pregnant, I was actually directing the show for the Cortland Repertory Theater in just outside of Syracuse, New York. And I stepped away, got the telephone call, and I came back in. And the song that they were singing, they were rehearsing, the cast was rehearsing at the time, was My Little Girl.
No.
That was the song that Cal,
the actor. You could not have scripted that any better.
He was, so really, I have to say, that is my favorite song.
Sharon Gamble with Dawn Farrell of Actors Theater of Indiana. A Grand Night for Singing, the music of Rodgers and Hammerstein, is on stage at the Carmel Community Playhouse through August 1st. Get more information at actorstheaterofindiana.org. Again, Actors Theater, that's with an R-E, ofindiana.org.
Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
You know, we recently celebrated Independence Day, but there's a French holiday coming up.
Ooh la la.
Ooh la la. Although I don't really have any calendar items that directly relate to Bastille Day, but we can segue with the best of them on that calendar thing we call Bastille Vidor.
What do we do?
Great minds on the same wavelength.
So what are you going to do?
Celebrate. Okay, here, you have to follow this line of logic.
Okay.
I have something very romantic to do. The French are known as a romantic people. French is a romance language. And hence, I'm going to recommend that you and your sweetie, well, actually, you should probably take your wife, who is your sweetie, mm-hmm. go to Heart Songs, a playfully romantic cabaret. Roger Schmelzer, who is a local singer and does musical theater as well as he's a great fan of jazz and the classic torch songs, he's put together a show that will be at the cabaret at the Columbia Club on Saturday, July 17th at 8 o'clock. And there's a dinner available as well. And he was in for an interview recently, which we'll hear in the future, but I'm telling you about this now because tickets are going pretty fast.
That's right. That should be a great show.
There you go.
Yeah, Cabaret at the Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, actually, something that's going on, if you're listening to our show on Friday night, you can still check this out. It's the Avant Grande Art Show that is being put on. It's an event featuring the artwork of Starbucks baristas. How fun. And it's benefiting young audiences of Indiana. It's taking place at the Stutz Building tonight, Stutz 2. It goes until 11 p.m. So if you're listening to us on Friday night, you can still check it out. If not, not, well, just go to the Young Audiences website at yind.org to find out about all the great stuff they do.
I'm eager to see if there's something where the medium is coffee grounds.
I actually have a friend of mine who lives appropriately enough in Seattle who makes paintings with paint he makes from coffee.
That is totally cool.
Very cool.
And as a bonus, if you put one in your bedroom, you wake up faster.
That's right.
Hey, I have a little road trip, and it's especially pertinent if you're listening Friday night, but Saturday afternoon, you still have time to get down to Louisville. It's just a couple of hours straight shot down the highway. And I've never been to this, but friends have, and they highly recommend the Forecastle Fest, which is at Waterfront Park in Louisville. It's all weekend through Sunday, and more than 100 bands, including some pretty big-name headliners, Smashing Pumpkins, Widespread Panic, Flaming Lips, Spoon, Devo, Cake, Drive-By Truckers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It just goes and goes and goes, I know. And you can find out more at forecastlefest.com, spelled just like you think it is.
Something to do on Saturday this weekend is to go check out the very, very cool new shop in Irvington on East Washington Street, and it is Homespun, which is the new collaborative effort that is featuring the work of designers and artists and craftsmen, and it's all brought to you by the same people who have put on the Indiana Handicraft Exchange events, and now they actually have their own shop in Irvington, Homespun. Check out, the grand opening is on Saturday.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. Love that. More local art. We like that. Okay, so here's something you can do. I'm really reaching for a connection to Bastille Day on this one. I'm not aware that there's a particular connection between France and the Etch-a-Sketch. Are you aware of one?
The Etch-a-Sketch I'm is sure red.
There you go. And you could use an Etch-a-Sketch to write in French.
Of course you could.
But you'd have to work really hard to do it at the world's largest Etch-a-Sketch, which was created to celebrate 50 years of this iconic toy. And it was created specifically for the Children's Museum of Indianapolis. It's more than 8 feet tall. It does work. It's a more than 6 foot wide screen. And there's a mechanism that you work together with your friends or family to use to shake it to erase whatever you just wrote in French in honor of Bastille Day. And that's on view through August 1st at the Children's Museum. So go play with the giant Etch-a-Sketch.
Very cool. Hey, coming up July 15th through the 25th, a 10-day Indianapolis International Film Festival, the 2010 edition. It's 112 films from 21 countries in 10 days, and you can get passes for all of them or some of them or part of them. And again, it's taking place at the IMA this year. Again, it's the 2010 Indianapolis International Film Fest. Check that out. That's going to be a great time. Looking forward to that. You can get more information at indiefilmfest.org.
Absolutely. Great, great idea. Hey, if you are thinking about a relative staycation, you should think about French Lick. A lot of people know about West Baden Springs and French Lick and how they were built in southern Indiana specifically to honor the fact that at some various times in the last century our economy has not been at its best, let's say. And people became aware that it would be cool to have wonderful vacation destinations right here in the Midwest. And there's so much going on at West Baden Springs and French Lick all the time. But in particular, French Lick, their Visitors Association has put together a lot of special packages, including family fun packages, where you can tour the area. You can go to Amish Country, Holiday World, Spring Mill State Park, Marengo Cave, much, much more. And also, if you have teenagers and you're thinking about, you know, what do I do with them because it's hard to impress them, check out, in French Lick, Indiana, Pluto's Teen Club, which allows no adults. But there's a bowling alley and video games and dance music and snack foods and all sorts of great fun, healthy fun for your teenage kids.
And last thing I've got is actually taking place on Bastille Day, the 14th, from Wednesday from 5 to 7. Cheryl Jock is going to be out at Book Mamas in Irvington discussing her new book, The Magnolia Principle. We actually had Cheryl on the show last spring when was talking about the garden she created for the Home Patio Show that was based on the book as well. That should be a lot of fun. Cheryl Jock at Book Mamas, July 14th, 5 to 7.
D, Did you seriously let me get away with French Lick and not make the connection to Bastille Day? So anyway, have a nice glass of French wine.
Fini. And we'll be back next week with more on
What'll We Do? Holiday Free.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
We can finally tell you the 2010 Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award recipient has been named. Indiana resident Scott Russell Sanders was chosen as the national recipient this week by the awards panel. The annual award seeks to recognize the contributions of Indiana authors to the literary landscape in Indiana and across the nation. The Indiana Authors Award is a program of the Indianapolis Marion County Public Library Foundation and is funded through the generosity of the Glick Fund, a fund of Central Indiana Community Foundation. Travis DiNicola spoke with Sanders about the award and his work.
Scott, let me just start off by saying congratulations to you.
Thanks very much. It is a great honor and a humbling honor.
This is pretty neat. It's also pretty special, I would think, because last year you were a runner-up for the Indiana Authors Award.
I was a runner-up to the magnificent James Alexander Tom, Jim Tom, who is a longtime friend of mine and also a writer whose work I have admired for decades. So it seemed to me a really superb way for this award to be inaugurated by honoring a man of his caliber.
Well, and if I remember correctly, because I was at the award ceremony last year, in fact, got to sit with you at the table you were at.
Yes.
If I remember, Tom actually talked about you in his acceptance speech.
He did, but before he talked about me, quite appropriately, he talked about the man who, had he lived, would almost certainly have been standing where Jim was, and that was, of course, Kurt Vonnegut Jr.,
yes,
who had died the previous year, who was, up until his death, certainly without question, the most widely celebrated and justly celebrated Indiana writer. He made a fine tribute to Kurt Vonnegut. And although Jim Tom and Kurt Vonnegut would seem to be quite different novelists, kinds of writers, a historical novelist on the one hand and a fantasy, speculative fiction, zany writer on the other, but in fact they had many of the same concerns.
And what I'm very curious about is how do you fit in that tradition as well? You're both a naturalist writer, nonfiction, but you've also written fiction as well.
I have, and books for children. Well, I wasn't born in Indiana, unlike Jim Tom and unlike Kurt Vonnegut. I am the first person to win this award who has strong ties to Indiana, which, as you know, is part of the crucial criterion for the award. It's not just writers born in Indiana, but it's writers who have strong ties. I've lived in Indiana since 1971, and when I arrived here to take up a position at Indiana University in Bloomington and begin my residence here, I was married to, was and still am, happily married to a Hoosier girl, Ruth McClure from Indianapolis. And in my earliest writing here, my imagination was still in the places where I had grown up, mainly Tennessee and Ohio. But after living in Bloomington for about 5 years, I really invested my imagination in this place. And from that time onward, much of my fiction and most of my nonfiction has been set in Indiana in general and in southern Indiana in particular.
In fact, one of your recent books, Conservationist Manifesto, was published by Indiana University.
Yes, it's my fourth book published by Indiana University Press, which the people of Indiana may not realize is one of the very greatest university presses in the country. I think it ranks about sixth or seventh in terms of titles published and also consistently wins high awards. Mm-hmm. So I've published an early book called Stone Country about the limestone workers and quarriers of southern Indiana, a book called Writing from the Center, which is a collection of essays, a historical novel, which was actually a reprint called Bad Man Ballad, and this most recent book that you mentioned, A Conservationist Manifesto. So I'm very proud of my university press and proud on behalf of all Hoosiers that this publisher is in our state.
The award for the Indiana Authors Award for actually recognizes your entire body of work, not
a
specific work, and not even it's not limited to a specific style or genre.
Right.
Tell me though a bit about Conservationist Manifesto, since that is one of your most recent works.
It's a collection of essays, all of which, as the title would suggest, have to do with envisioning a shift from a culture based on consumption to a culture based on stewardship and caretaking. I think it was a book that was conceived and, in fact, submitted to the publisher before the economic meltdown that we are all still suffering the consequences of.
Mm-hmm.
I think perhaps the message of the book, which is the need to live in a more conserving way as individuals and as a society, I think the message of the book is even more timely now than when I completed it and delivered it to Indiana University Press. So it's a book which argues the ethical, practical, and philosophical reasons for shifting to a way of life which is more conserving and which preserves the blessings and abundance of our planet for future generations.
Is it also in any way a how-to book? I mean, certainly you're looking at the motivation for why you do that, but, I mean, is it practical as well?
Well, it's practical at the level of individuals. That is, the book is filled with examples of how individuals and households have made decisions to live in a simpler, a materially simpler way, in a spiritually richer way. I don't pretend to have policy advice to give to the society as a whole. I don't pretend to be either an economist or a policymaker. Certainly there are other people writing extremely well about those matters. So I'm really writing at the level of values and also at the level of individual behavior. I realize full well that we need to make changes at all levels, at national policy, state policy. Corporations need to re-envision their role in the world, and individuals and households need to shift how they behave. But my focus really is on the underlying values, that the ones that inform our present way of life, which by any measure is a ruinous way of life, and the values that we need for a more conserving way of life.
Mm-hmm. Now, in addition to the nonfiction, you've also, I know, have been returning to writing more fiction the past few years, including a work that's been in the Kenyon Review, the North American Review. One thing that I want to mention is the book A Private History of Awe,
yes,
which has to be one of my favorite titles ever.
Well, thank you. That is the only memoir I have written or expect to write. It's my shorthand description of it, Travis, is that it's a spiritual testament, a love story, and a coming-of-age memoir. And it came out in 2006 and is still very much in print and was actually nominated by the publisher for a Pulitzer Prize, which indicates that the publisher thought quite highly of it.
Mm-hmm.
My current writing is divided between essays, which I have been writing pretty consistently for the last 25 years, as well as a novel. I'm working on a novel that is set partly in the state of Indiana and partly in other states where I have spent considerable amounts of time, such as Vermont and Ohio. So I'm moving back and forth between work on fiction and on nonfiction. Mm-hmm. And although they may seem to non-writers like quite different forms, I feel that both my nonfiction, my essays and memoir, and my fiction, my novels and short stories, are powered by the same concerns and the same preoccupations.
Let me ask you, how does winning the Indiana Authors Award, how do you anticipate that affecting either your work or maybe just getting your work to a wider audience?
Well, of course, one always hopes to reach a wider audience, not just for the obvious egotistical reasons that everybody would take for granted, but because if you believe in your work and you have devoted yourself to your work, you hope that it will speak to as many people as possible. I think that writers in, not just in Indiana, but writers in the Midwest, suffer a certain disadvantage with respect to the national media. Our work tends not to be reviewed on the coasts, which are still culturally the most influential locations, obviously places like New York and Boston, mm-hmm. Los Angeles and San Francisco and Seattle and so forth. And it's not only that our works tend not to be reviewed in the most influential national media. There's often an assumption that what goes on in a place like Indiana or, let's say, Illinois or Iowa or any Midwestern state, that what goes on here is somehow less sophisticated, less cutting edge, less likely to be compelling than what goes on in one of the great urban centers. That's a very old prejudice. It's one that we're not going to turn around overnight, but one hopes that an award like this, not just for me, but for mm-hmm. For the person this year who wins the regional award, the person who wins the Emerging Writers Award, and those who won last year and those who will win in future years, that for all of these writers, it will bring more attention to the good work that is being done by people who live in Indiana and also people who were born here, live elsewhere, but still have strong ties to the state.
Travis DiNicola with the 2010 Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award winner, Scott Russell Sanders. Award finalists in all three categories for the award will be honored on October 9, 2010, at Central Library. The day's events will include free public programs such as author lectures from this year's Indiana Authors Award honorees, how to get published workshops for aspiring writers, and book sales and signings featuring authors from around the state. A ticketed award dinner and fundraiser benefiting the Library Foundation will follow that evening, where the winner of the Regional Author and Emerging Author categories will each be named. Sanders will serve as the dinner's keynote speaker. Ticket information for the Indiana Authors Award dinner is available at IndianaAuthorsAward.org. Again, IndianaAuthorsAward.org. Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4. I'll find out how an art paper company is going green.
And, of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 for The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.